During mental prayer, my desire to know and love God became so strong and so compelling that it left me completely shattered and exhausted. This desire didn't seem right to me. I thought I ought to repress it, because it might involve self-seeking. I knew I should come before the Lord empty of any desires. That didn't bring me any peace, either. Then I tried to think of great intentions that would be pleasing to my God: the conversion of unbelievers, the reunion of the churches, an end to war. But I was never quite sure that the intention I had chosen was exactly the one God had in mind. Weeks passed. I still felt that my mental prayer failed to meet the Lord's expectations. Finally, one day an idea came to me that was so simple I was surprised I hadn't thought of it sooner. Since I was never sure of acting according to God's preference, why not be content to want with all my strength whatever God wanted deep within me, communing with all my will to God's will? Or better still, why not let the divine will envelop me totally? Then I would be sure of not making a mistake, of not disregarding God's wishes with respect to others and myself. Then I could be sure of offering Him exactly the prayer that He was expecting of me. This time I was at peace deep inside of me. Since then, whenever I don't find inner peace, it is a sign that I have allowed myself to be distracted from God's will. And so I turn back to it at once. 95. Beacons along the road. Madam, I should like to comply with your request that I retrace the spiritual development of your late husband, but that is not easy. How and by what stages did he achieve the resplendent spiritual life that so impressed those around him? It's true that I was the witness to, and the confidant of, his spiritual efforts over many years. But the most important things happened within him, at a depth to which I had no access. Even so, I shall try to retrace the principal stages in his life of prayer, as I thought I discerned them. When I met your husband almost 12 years ago, he was a man of profound faith, as you know better than I. He almost always reacted to the events of life as a believer. When one of his children was sick, when he had to make an important business decision, when you had your serious accident, his first reaction was to turn to God. You remember his great faith in the fatherhood of God, which he expressed in Christ's own words: "Ask and you shall receive. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be open to you." Mount 7:7. One day, I sensed that he had entered a new spiritual phase. During a conversation with him, it became clear to me that for several months his prayer had been undergoing a transformation. He was no longer petitioning God for temporal goods. He was seeking the riches of the kingdom, and he was doing it with great insistence. When I pointed out to him that it is perfectly legitimate to pray to God for our temporal needs, he did not argue with me. But, in a tone that touched me deeply, he reminded me of Christ's words: "It is not for you to be in search of what you are to eat or drink. Stop worrying. The unbelievers of this world are always running after these things. Your Father knows that you need such things. Seek out instead His kingship over you, and the rest will follow in turn." LK 12:29-31. Your husband was filled with a very keen desire for the grace which he was experiencing more and more. It was a grace that led him to correct his faults, and inspired him to a more profound prayer. It was a grace of peace and joy which, through him, touched the souls of those who came to him for counsel. It was at this time, as you must certainly remember, that he devoted himself with so much love to helping a young delinquent boy. A few years later, I came to realize that this stage had also been exceeded. One day, when we were speaking of mental prayer, he quoted the following words of a mystic: "What a great difference there is between the person who goes to the feast for the feast's sake, and the one who goes to encounter the Beloved." Very often during the following months, in his conversations and letters, certain verses from the Psalms would recur that revealed his state of soul. "O God, you are my God whom I seek. For you my flesh pines and my soul thirsts like the earth, parched, lifeless and without water. PS 63:2. A thirst is my soul for God, the living God. When shall I go and behold the face of God? PS 42:3. I stretch out my hands to you, my soul thirsts for you like parched land. PS 143:6. When I talked with him, it was clear that he no longer aspired to the riches of this world or even, in a certain sense, to those of the kingdom. He now yearned not for God's gifts, but for the gift of God himself. Years passed, and this yearning continued to consume him. He was eager to read the great spiritual authors, and to meet persons who would speak to him of his God. It was as if he kept hoping to discover a secret, the means of encountering this God who had captivated him, so as to never again be separated from him. There was something extraordinarily poignant in this need for God, at once impatient and peaceful, that welled up from the depths of his being. It manifested itself in his conversations with me, and certainly must have found expression in his mental prayer through heart-rending cries. I believe I can safely say that your husband had attained to authentic evangelical detachment, not through scorn for the good things of the earth, but thanks to the fascination he had for an incomparably more desirable good. Then there was a time when I was baffled. I kept wondering whether his fervor was declining. I no longer perceived the throbbing of his heart consumed by a fever for God. Even so, I was not worried, because peace and joy, I was about to say, the Holy Spirit, poured from him. I had proof of this in his growing influence on others. It was at this period of his life that he prepared the Jewish professor for baptism, the one whom you welcomed so graciously into your home. I continued to misidentify the work of grace within your husband, until the day he unknowingly gave me the key to it by speaking about a state beyond desire. I questioned him about it. Here is his answer almost word for word. It's true that for years my entire spiritual life consisted in an insatiable desire for God. Then one day, it was as if all desire was dead. I was very frightened. I was convinced that I had lost God. The sentiment of intense life, fed by the desire to encounter the Lord and lose myself in him, was superseded by a void, a spiritual languor. I didn't know if I still had faith. I was certain that I no longer loved God, since I could not discern the slightest desire for him within me. You were not there to help me understand God's will. I felt as though I had emerged from a long-lived illusion. I was both calm and desolated, the way one speaks of a desolate land. I saw the light when I remembered, with a certain nostalgia, the prayer which had so often escaped my lips during the preceding years, "Lord, I hunger and thirst for you." For the first time, I understood that this prayer was not poor enough, "I hunger. I thirst." Apostrophe the T was still too much in the foreground. It was far too much alive, when it should have been crucified. One after the other, I had renounced the good of this world, and then the goods of the kingdom. Now I had to renounce even the desire for God. I mean, that I must no longer desire union with God for my sake, but for God's. This union must no longer be a desire emanating from me, but a desire emanating from God within me. That day, we talked for a long time about this new stage in his life of mental prayer. Several months later, when you informed me of his accidental death, I was reminded of a passage from Emile de Mengham's Vie des Saints Musulmans, Lives of the Muslim Saints, that he had quoted to me with intense joy during our last conversation. A voice cried out to me, "O Abu Yazid, what do you desire?" I answered, "I desire to desire nothing because I am the desired and you are the one who desires." 96. It's you. A Muslim student came to see me. He had read one of the issues of Kehiyazur Verzon, and wanted to meet me. At the end of our conversation he told me, with exquisite courtesy, that he wanted to leave a Muslim legend with me in remembrance of his visit, and as a sign of his gratitude. And he added, "I'm sure you will like it very much. Actually, I like this legend so much that my entire letter to you today will consist in acquainting you with it." One night a lover, filled with audacity and the spirit of conquest, knocked at the door of his beloved. She asked, "Who's there?" He answered, "It's I." She refused to open and said harshly, "Go away." With wild rage, the young man went off swearing that he would forget her, and that in fact he had already forgotten her. He traveled over the wide expanse of the world. But he could not forget. And love brought him back irresistibly to his beloved's door. There was the same dialogue as before. However, this time, when she sent him away, she added a mysterious little sentence, "You have still not said the only word that would permit me to open to you." Indignant, baffled and crushed, the young man went off again. This time, he didn't go to seek forgetfulness in journeys to distant lands. He went down into solitary gorges, to spend long hours in meditation. Gradually, his anger and passion gave way to wisdom. His love gained in depth what it had lost in violence. After many years, it led our lover back again, this time timid, humble, and more ardent than ever, towards his beloved. He knocked discreetly at her door. "Who is there?" In a low tone of voice he answered, "It's you." And immediately the door was thrown open. My Muslim visitor made no comments on his legend. Indeed, what need was there for that? It is as clear as a running stream. To engage in mental prayer is to knock at the door behind which the great life of God is ablaze, resplendent with light, love and joy. When the person who knocks is stripped of self, and has surrendered all the room in his soul to the Lord, he can say in all truth, "It's you." Then the door opens to the long-desired union with God. 97. God's rest. You are perplexed because you feel inclined to rest during mental prayer, whereas, until now, you had the sense of engaging in intense activity of mind and heart. You wonder whether it is a temptation to indifference. Do you not perhaps have, along with so many of our contemporaries, a rather low esteem of repose, reserving your enthusiasm for action? Of course, distinctions must be made. There are many kinds of repose. But to suspect all repose a priori is a serious error. If certain kinds of rest are nothing but sloth and indolence, there are others, and they deserve respect, addressed to nurturing and renewing strength for the sake of more effective action. There are nobler types of rest, as well. Read the Epistle to the Hebrews, Heb 4, Passim. It gives us good news, the promise of entering into God's rest. It is reserved for the people of God, and therefore offered to each of its members. The author of the Epistle concludes, "Let us strive to enter into that rest," Heb 4:11. The expression "God's rest" is a very ancient one. In the Bible, it is used to designate the promised land. To enter into this land is to accede to God's rest. But the promised land is only an image, and a very imperfect one, of God's true rest to which we are invited. And that is heaven. Like the promised land, heaven must be laboriously conquered. Does this mean that we must renounce seeking God's rest before entering the homeland? On the road, we are provided with divine stopping places, hours and places of rest. Didn't Jesus Christ say, "Come to me, all you who are weary and find life burdensome, and I will refresh you. Learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart. Your souls will find rest." Mt 11:28-29. We can, indeed we must, seek God's rest. We must strive to enter into it, as the Epistle to the Hebrews exhorts us to do. But let us delve even more deeply into this biblical notion of God's rest. The expression "God's rest" must not be understood only as the rest that God offers us. It is also the rest that God Himself enjoys. Let me explain.